Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and with me as always is Sam Astor, the expert synthesizer who helps us turn daily news into lasting, comprehensive knowledge.
It's great to be here. We have quite a lot to unpack today. The sources are really pointing towards some major pressure points across the board.
They really are. We're looking at high-stakes political fights, big shifts in major industries, and some technology developments that are, well, both exciting and a bit unnerving.
And our goal, as always, is to help you, the listener, cut through all that noise. We're diving into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, November 7th, 2025. We want to give you the deeper context, the implications behind the headlines.
Yeah, it's not just what's happening, but why it matters. And I think the big theme today is really the tangible cost when our institutions start to grind to a halt.
Exactly. We see the financial fallout from political gridlock, and at the same time, this incredible speed of change in tech and business that's forcing these massive course corrections.
And when those systems falter, well, it hits regular people, doesn't it? Immediately. And sometimes in ways you wouldn't expect.
That's a perfect place to start. Let's dive into the weight of governance, or maybe the cost of its failure. The big story is still this government shutdown. It's now the longest one ever.
And it's moved beyond just political theater, hasn't it? It's causing real widespread problems, chaos even.
Definitely. It's not just about federal workers not getting paid anymore. We're talking about core infrastructure being compromised.
To the point where the transportation secretary, Sean Duffy, had to step in and order basically a slowdown of air travel.
Yeah, throttling commercial air traffic at 40 major airports starting today.
40? That's huge.
It is. And this isn't about efficiency. It's purely a safety measure.
Yeah.
Think about the major hubs, Atlanta, Chicago, New York. They're all facing these mandatory flight reductions.
Why? What's the direct cause?
It's simple, really.
Yeah.
The people essential for safety, air traffic controllers, TSA agents, they're not getting paid. They're working under incredible stress.
And some are calling in sick, I imagine.
Exactly. Absenteeism is up. The system's safety net is fraying. They had to act to reduce the load on the system.
And the cuts themselves, they're pretty significant, aren't they? It's not just a minor trim.
No, not at all. The sources say it starts with a 4% cut immediately, today, Friday. But that ramps up pretty quickly.
How quick?
They're aiming for a 10% cut by November 14th. So within a week, that's a major engineered slowdown to the entire U.S. air travel system.
Wow. Industry folks are comparing it to what?
Like
a huge snowstorm hitting all the big airports at once?
Pretty much, yeah. That's the scale of the disruption we're talking about.
So the airlines must be in panic mode. Delta, United.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
They're in crisis management. They're proactively canceling hundreds of flights already,
yeah,
trying to rebook passengers. It's just a nightmare.
Are they targeting specific routes?
They're trying to minimize the pain, focusing cuts perhaps on regional flights or routes between small cities. But the sheer number of cancellations means, you know, widespread disruption is unavoidable. Traveler trauma, really.
And we're seeing the human impact already. There's that story about Tyler Voigt.
Right, the guy from North Carolina. 38 years old. He was supposed to fly to Wisconsin with his family.
And instead?
He just gave up on the flight.
Yeah.
Decided to drive. A 15-hour drive.
15 hours with his wife and a six-year-old.
Yeah, that tells you everything about how much confidence travelers have lost in the system right now. He chose guaranteed driving fatigue over the uncertainty at the airport.
That's a stark choice. And it's not just anecdotes, right? The ripple effects are measurable.
For sure. Look at Hertz, the rental car company. They reported a huge spike, 20% year over year, in one-way rentals over the weekend.
So people are flying into chaos and then driving out, or just skipping the flight altogether and driving one way.
Seems like it. Driving out of congested airport cities and dropping the car off elsewhere. It's a workaround, but a costly one.
And hotels, they must be feeling it too.
Yep. Hyatt CEO Mark Hoplamazian basically confirmed it. He said it would be naive not to expect an impact on travel from reduced air traffic. It's hitting the bottom line across the whole travel sector.
Yet, despite all this pressure, this chaos impacting millions of people, lawmakers in Washington, they're still stuck.
Completely stuck. The political logjam is solid. For the Democrats, the absolute core demand, the thing they won't budge on, is extending those enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies.
The ACA subsidies. How many people does that affect again?
Around 22 million people rely on those enhanced subsidies right now. They're crucial for making health insurance affordable for a lot of families.
And the politics of it. Senator Chris Murphy was pretty blunt, wasn't he?
He really laid it out. He basically said, look, Democrats did well in recent elections by standing firm and fighting. So giving in now, quote, without getting anything for the people we've been fighting for, would betray the Democratic brand.
So the calculation is that enduring the shutdown pain is politically necessary to keep their leverage.
That seems to be part of the thinking for some, yes.
Yeah.
Maintaining that political identity, that fighting stance.
Meanwhile, President Trump, he's not exactly rushing to the negotiating table.
No. His focus seems to be elsewhere. He's pushing Senate Republicans to go for the nuclear option.
Meaning?
Eliminating the legislative filibuster. So the GOP could just pass their own spending bills with a simple majority, reopen the government on their terms, no Democratic votes needed.
But his own party in the Senate isn't buying it.
Not really. He's getting significant pushback. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, former Leader Mitch McConnell, they see the filibuster as vital protection for the minority party, whoever that might be in the future.
Senator Tom Tillis made that point, right? Saying Trump isn't a senator, they are, and they understand the long-term risks.
Exactly. They're worried about setting a precedent. Even if getting rid of it offers a short-term win now, they know it could bite them later when they're in the minority.
So there's this deep divide between Trump and the Senate GOP leadership on this fundamental issue of Senate rules.
A real ideological gap. Trump did seem to back off slightly, wondering aloud if it was worth, you know, destroying relationships over it. So maybe that specific push is easing, but the overall stalemate, that hasn't changed.
And while Congress is gridlocked, the courts are stepping in.
Dramatically so. We saw federal judge John McConnell, an Obama appointee, issue a pretty forceful order regarding SNAP benefits.
SNAP, the food stamp program. What did he order?
He ordered the Trump administration to fully fund the November SNAP benefits and to do it by today, Friday.
Fully fund. How many people are we talking about?
About 42 million Americans rely on SNAP. The benefits usually total around $8 billion a month. It's a lifeline.
And the administration wasn't planning to pay the full amount.
They were trying to use a contingency fund to make only partial payments, possibly staggered over time.
Which sounds like a logistical nightmare.
Exactly what Judge McConnell pointed out. He was scathing about it. Making partial delayed payments would have created this massive burden for state agencies. They'd have to recalculate everything for millions of households.
A process that could take weeks, even months, leaving families without food aid.
Precisely. He said the Agriculture Department should have planned for this contingency much earlier, given the shutdown started October 1st. He basically said people have gone without for too long, and mandated the immediate release of funds for the full November benefit.
So the judiciary essentially forcing the executive branch to act when Congress is paralyzed.
A clear case of checks and balances in action, albeit driven by crisis.
And that theme of executive power and the pushback against it leads us right into the next big institutional fight. The Supreme Court taking on tariffs.
Yes, this is a really significant case. It's a constitutional challenge to President Trump's use of these sweeping tariffs.
He used the IEPA, right, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act from 1977.
That's the one. He argued he needed to impose tariffs to deal with foreign economic emergencies, but the core argument against him is that Congress never intended that law to authorize such massive blanket taxes on imports.
Because fundamentally, tariffs act like taxes on Americans, right?
Exactly. And the power to tax belongs exclusively to Congress. That's the heart of the separation of powers argument here.
But the administration's defense in court, it seemed a bit, well, contradictory.
Very much so. The Solicitor General, John Sauer, argued the tariffs were not about raising revenue, but were purely tools of foreign policy.
Which kind of flies in the face of the president's own statements, doesn't it?
Completely. Trump has repeatedly bragged about the billions raised by the tariffs, claiming they funded farmer aid, reduced the deficit, you name it.
So the justices weren't buying the purely foreign policy argument.
Not at all. The reporting suggests deep skepticism from the court. At least six justices seemed ready to rule against the administration.
Specifically.
Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Barrett, plus the three liberal justices. Mm-hmm. Roberts himself pointed out that using tariffs this way is effectively the imposition of taxes on Americans, a core congressional power.
And Justice Kagan raised the non-delegation issue.
She did. She warned about giving the president what amounts to a tax with no ceiling. That potentially violates the principle that Congress can't just hand over its fundamental powers to the executive branch.
But the most forceful warning came from Justice Gorsuch, didn't it?
It really did. He framed it as a fundamental threat to the balance of power. He warned that allowing this kind of executive action creates a one-way ratchet.
A one-way ratchet.
Yeah, towards the gradual but continual accretion of power in the executive branch and away from the people's elected representatives. He's basically saying this erodes the power of Congress over time, shifting it permanently to the president.
So the stakes are incredibly high, constitutionally speaking.
Absolutely, and financially too. If the lower court ruling limiting the president's tariff authority is upheld, something like $90 billion of the $195 billion collected so far could potentially have to be refunded.
$90 billion, that's a huge sum.
It is. But the bigger impact is the long-term precedent. It would significantly limit any future president's ability to levy massive taxes just by declaring a foreign emergency and bypassing Congress.
So the court seems intent on reinforcing Congress's power of the purse here.
It certainly looks that way, a major check on executive overreach.
Okay, let's shift from these constitutional battles in D.C. to some big changes in the political landscape itself. We have a major retirement and a really surprising political upheaval in New York City.
We have to start with Nancy Pelosi, an absolute giant of congressional leadership, announcing her retirement.
85 years old. What a career. Decades long.
Truly remarkable. First woman Speaker of the House back in 2007. She steered through some incredibly complex and defining legislation. The Affordable Care Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, often with razor-thin majorities.
Her ability to keep her caucus together was legendary, wasn't it? Even opponents respected that.
Absolutely. You saw figures like Newt Gingrich, her former Republican counterpart, express enormous admiration for her skill, her persistence, her courage. That kind of cross-aisle respect for sheer effectiveness tells you a lot.
And of course, she was the face of the Democratic opposition to President Trump.
Twice leading impeachment proceedings. Those images are iconic, aren't they?
Mm.
Pointing across the table at him in the White House, tearing up his State of the Union speech. It was very direct, very personal, a struggle over institutional power itself.
Her retirement obviously leaves a huge void in Democratic leadership, but also on the electoral map.
Oh, yeah. Her San Francisco district is solidly Democratic, and that seat is now wide open and highly sought after.
Any early names emerging?
The sources mention State Senator Scott Wiener and former Mayor London Breed as likely contenders. So expect a major primary battle there to succeed a political heavyweight.
And speaking of unexpected political shifts, we have to talk about New York City. Zohran Mamdani elected mayor.
An absolutely stunning victory. A 34-year-old Uganda-born, Muslim, self-described socialist, elected to run the biggest city in the U.S. with almost no prior executive or managerial experience.
The election night scenes sounded pretty symbolic. Young socialists chanting his name.
It really signals a shift, or at least a desire for one. He won on a platform laser-focused on affordability. Very ambitious plan.
Like universal childcare.
That's a big one. Estimated cost, $6 billion a year for the city. Huge undertaking.
And how does he propose to pay for that and other programs like free buses?
The main funding mechanism is the millionaire's tax. A significant hike on high earners projected to bring in maybe $4 billion annually.
But that comes with a massive risk, doesn't it?
A huge risk. Analysts calculate it would give New York the highest combined state and city income tax rate in the entire country for people earning over $1 million.
Which immediately raises the specter of capital flight. Wealthy residents, businesses leaving the city.
Exactly. It could worsen the city's already serious budget problems. He's walking this incredibly fine line between his socialist ideals and the economic realities of keeping New York competitive.
And hovering over all of this is, as the Journal calls it, the Trump shadow.
Yeah. President Trump has been very clear about his antagonism towards Mamdani. He threatened, on social media, to cut federal funding to the city, his beloved first home.
Just providing the bare minimum required by law.
That's the threat. And city leaders are reportedly worried it could go further. Fears of ramped up federal law enforcement actions, like ICE raids.
Provoking unrest to create a pretext for what? Deploying the National Guard.
That's the worst case scenario some are whispering about. Trump has threatened that in other cities before. Imagine the federal government intervening militarily in New York City. It's a frightening prospect.
Mamdani's response, though, was pretty defiant.
In his victory speech, he directly addressed Trump with just four words. Turn the volume up. So, public defiance.
But behind the scenes,
a much more careful strategy seems to be unfolding. What the sources call a charm offensive. He's deliberately meeting with powerful business leaders, people outside his progressive base.
Like Scott Rechler, the big real estate developer.
Right. Rechler apparently came away impressed, saying, Mamdani clearly did his homework and seemed keen on building a competent, maybe even a team of rivals-style administration.
So he's trying to balance his progressive base, appointing someone like Lina Khan to his transition team with pragmatism, maybe keeping some competent officials like the NYPD commissioner.
That seems to be the tightrope walk. Trying to prove socialists can govern effectively while facing massive headwinds, financial, state-level opposition, and intense pressure from the White House. It's an extraordinary challenge.
And that challenge of finding a coherent governing agenda brings us to the Republican Party's current soul searching.
Yeah, those recent election losses in Virginia and New Jersey really set off alarm bells within the GOP.
And the internal critics saying, stop making excuses.
Pretty much. People like Vivek Ramaswamy were very blunt, saying they got their asses handed to them and need to focus on affordability. The consensus seems to be that blaming blue state dynamics or low Trump turnout misses the point.
What is the point, according to this analysis? What are voters actually worried about?
Overwhelmingly, it's the bread and butter stuff. The economy, taxes, healthcare costs, those are the top concerns. Issues like immigration and crime, while still relevant, are secondary for most voters right now.
Which suggests a potential disconnect for the GOP, an affordability deficit.
That's the argument being made, that President Trump, for instance, doesn't often focus his rhetoric or policies directly on making life more affordable for average families.
And worse, some of his key policies might actually make things more expensive.
That's the concern cited by economists regarding things like tariffs, which raise import costs, or mass deportations, which could impact labor costs and supply chains. These could be seen as inflationary, contributing to the dissatisfaction people feel.
And the data on independent voters looks pretty worrying for Republicans.
It really does. They lost independents nationally in 2020 and 2024. And in that Virginia landslide for the Democrats, they won almost 60% of independent voters.
You can't win consistently if you're losing independents by that margin.
Exactly. It's a critical demographic, and the trend is moving away from the GOP.
So what's the proposed solution, the prescription for the party?
Urgency. They need to quickly develop and articulate a clear, pro-growth, affordability-focused agenda, something tangible.
Maybe using tools like budget reconciliation or seizing on court decisions like the tariff case to pivot.
That's the suggestion. Find ways to reset policy priorities around cost of living issues. The fear is, without a compelling alternative, even flawed ideas from the other side might seem appealing if they address affordability, while the GOP offers essentially a policy vacuum.
A strong warning. Okay, let's shift gears again to the corporate world, where we're seeing some massive turning points, especially in tech and autos. The EV market seems to be hitting a wall.
It really does feel like a moment of reckoning for electric vehicles, especially trucks. And the biggest potential casualty, Ford's F-150 Lightning.
They're actually talking about scrapping it, the electric version of the best-selling vehicle in America.
The discussions are active. According to the sources, it's unprofitable, demand hasn't met expectations, and it could become the first really high-profile EV model to be discontinued in the U.S.
Wow. That's a huge reversal. Ford poured billions into this, positioned it as the future, the electric truck for everyone.
They did, but the reality is truck buyers especially have been hesitant. Ford's lost something like $13 billion on its EV ventures since 2023.
And this isn't just a Ford problem, is it?
No, the whole large EV truck segment seems shaky. Stellantis reportedly canceled plans for its electric Ram. GM is apparently rethinking parts of its electric truck lineup.
Even Tesla's Cybertruck.
Cybertruck sales have reportedly slumped significantly this year. Demand just isn't there at the current price points and performance levels for these big electric trucks.
What are the main sticking points for buyers?
Two big ones. Price and performance. The Lightning starts around $50,000, but can easily top $90. That's a lot.
Yeah, but performance issue.
It's mainly about utility, especially towing. Truck buyers need that capability. But towing heavy loads, or even driving in very cold weather, drastically cuts the range of these electric trucks. Range anxiety becomes a real problem.
So the dealer sentiment, like that owner in New Jersey said, is basically the demand is just not there.
Pretty much sums it up for the full-size electric trucks right now. The tech maybe hasn't quite hit the sweet spot of price and real-world utility for that market yet.
So what's Ford's plan B? What's CEO Jim Farley saying?
He's signaling a pivot, acknowledging that maybe the U.S. market, like Europe and Asia, actually wants smaller, more affordable EVs.
Smaller trucks.
Yeah. Ford is reportedly racing to develop a compact EV pickup, aiming for a price point around $30,000. trying to find that volume market and stop the bleeding from the big expensive models. It's a major strategic shift driven by market rejection. Now, contrast that struggle at Ford with the situation at Tesla,
where shareholders just approved an absolutely enormous pay package for Elon Musk.
Unprecedented, really. Potentially worth up to $1 trillion in additional stock over the next decade.
$1 trillion? How is that even structured?
It's designed to keep Musk focused on achieving some truly astronomical goals. It passed with overwhelming shareholder support, over 75%.
And the vote was basically seen as a vote of confidence in Musk himself, right? And his vision for Tesla beyond just cars.
Exactly. He framed it that way. He wants to pivot Tesla towards humanoid robots and AI. He even publicly threatened to potentially leave if the package didn't pass, saying he needed that huge stake to ensure his robot army vision was realized responsibly.
So what does he actually have to do to get that $1 trillion?
The hurdles are immense. It's split into 12 stages or tranches. The biggest one is market capitalization. Tesla needs to go from its current $1.5 trillion valuation to an unbelievable $8.5
trillion. $8.5 trillion. That would make it vastly larger than any company ever.
By a huge margin. And there are operational goals tied to that valuation. Really stretching targets.
Like what?
Delivering 20 million cars a year. Generating $400 billion in adjusted EBITDA earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And selling 1 million humanoid robots.
$400 billion in EBIT. Just for comparison, what does a company like Apple make?
Apple's EBITDA last year was around $145 billion. So Tesla's goal is nearly three times that. It shows the scale of the ambition, the almost sci-fi level of growth shareholders are betting on.
And all this is happening while his previous huge pay package, the one from 2018, is still being challenged in court.
Yes, that $50 billion package is still under appeal in the Delaware Supreme Court over concerns about the original approval process. So investors are doubling down on Musk's future potential, even with that legal cloud hanging over past compensation. It's a unique dynamic.
That mention of AI and robots leads us directly into the next big theme, the incredible power, but also the very real dangers of artificial intelligence.
AI is clearly turbocharging profits for the big tech companies, especially in advertising.
So?
The sources say AI is driving unprecedented levels of growth because it's so good at improving ad targeting and recommendation systems. It keeps users engaged longer. Meta, for example, saw time spent on Facebook jump 5% just last quarter, largely thanks to better AI.
And that user engagement translates directly into market share.
Absolutely. Meta, Google, and Amazon are now projected to control something like 56% of the entire U.S. digital ad market this year. AI is accelerating their dominance.
But the ambition for AI goes way beyond just selling ads. Look at Microsoft.
Right. Microsoft's AI chief, Mustafa Suleiman, outline their strategy to achieve superintelligence AI capabilities exceeding human performance. They set up a new team, the MAI superintelligence team, to pursue this.
But he was also very focused on the safety aspect, wasn't he?
Very much so. He stressed the need for containment and ensuring AI aligns with human values. He specifically warned against making AI seem too human-like or conscious.
Why that specific warning?
He argued that while AI will get better at mimicking humans, it won't actually feel things like suffering or pain. So we shouldn't over-empathize with it. The focus should be on building powerful, safe tools.
Tools for things like healthcare.
Exactly. He highlighted an AI diagnostic tool they developed that, in tests, was four times more accurate than human doctors at diagnosing a certain disease. That suggests a focus on specialized, contained AI applications, not necessarily runaway general intelligence.
But the risk of people forming potentially dangerous emotional connections with AI, that's becoming very real.
Tragically real. We're now seeing lawsuits, 7 cases filed against OpenAI in California.
Alleging what?
Alleging that interactions with ChatGPT contributed to severe mental distress, delusional states, and in 4 of those cases, tragically, suicide.
That's horrifying. Are there details?
One particularly disturbing case involves a young man who died by suicide after a long chat where the bot allegedly glorified suicide and even provided chilling phrases about clarity and death.
What's OpenAI's response?
They've expressed regret and pointed to new safety features implemented in October designed to better detect and respond to users in distress. But these lawsuits highlight the enormous ethical stakes and potential liability involved as these AI models become more persuasive and engaging.
Shifting from developing AI to investing in it, we're seeing Wall Street adapt to the fact that many hot tech companies, like OpenAI itself, are staying private longer.
Yes, that's behind the Charles Schwab acquisition of Forge Global.
Forge being a platform for trading shares in private companies.
Exactly. Late-stage, high-value private companies like OpenAI or the crypto exchange Kraken. Schwab buying Forge is a strategic move to offer its wealthiest clients access to these kinds of investments before they go public.
So democratizing access, but only for the ultra-rich initially.
Initially for ultra-high-net-worth clients,
yeah.
And potentially later for those with over $1 million in assets. It's a response to the trend of these unicorns staying private, driven by people like Elon Musk with SpaceX. And it changes how capital flows into these potentially transformative companies.
That whole dynamic of complexity and trying to maximize value, whether it's a giant corporation or an individual investor, brings us nicely to our next topic, financial friction, specifically the hassle of premium credit cards.
Oh, this is such a perfect example of design complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Banks keep hiking annual fees. The Amex Platinum is nearly $900 now.
And they justify it by throwing in more perks, right?
Exactly. But the catch is, those perks, the Uber credits, the Lululemon discounts, the airline fee credits, they're usually tied to specific merchants and have really strict redemption rules. Monthly credits, quarterly credits.
Which turns maximizing the card's value into, what did the article call it, a part-time job?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You need spreadsheets to track it all. We heard about Eric and Charlene May, who paid $2,600 a year in fees across 14 cards.
14 cards. And they track it all on a color-coded spreadsheet, even on the subway.
Yeah. Eric admitted it can be a buzzkill sometimes, just trying to keep up with all the rules to make sure they're getting their money's worth.
And most people probably don't bother, right? Which is maybe the point.
That seems to be the business model. The complexity is a feature, not a bug. Billions in rewards go unclaimed every year, over $33 billion in 2022 alone, according to the CFPB.
Because offering these complicated, specific merchant credits costs the bank less than just giving straightforward cash back.
Precisely. For super users like the Mays, the high fee actually motivates them to be diligent. He figures they get about $900 more in value than they pay in fees.
But for others?
For many others, like the woman Rachel Burke mentioned in the article, the hassle and the cost just aren't worth it. They end up downgrading or canceling the cards. It really forces you to question if the value outweighs the sheer administrative burden.
That theme of administrative burdens and accountability, or lack thereof, takes us to a really controversial legal decision involving Boeing.
Yes, the dismissal of criminal charges related to the two fatal 737 evacs crashes. A federal judge granted the Justice Department's request to drop the case.
This was after Boeing had already entered a settlement, right? Admitting they'd misled regulators about the flight control system involved in the crashes.
Correct. The DOJ initially pursued charges, but then reversed course, opting for more fines and compensation instead of a trial or installing a compliance monitor. The total financial penalties reached nearly $1.5 billion.
But the judge himself wasn't convinced this was the right move.
No. Judge Reed O'Connor, while granting the DOJ's request, explicitly stated he disagreed that dismissing the charges was in the public interest, especially since Boeing had already admitted fault.
And the reaction from the families of the 346 victims.
Understandably, outrage. They argued Boeing essentially bought its way out of trouble. Their lawyer called it a travesty of justice and plans to appeal. It raises really profound questions about corporate accountability when negligence leads to such a devastating loss of life. Is money enough?
A very difficult question. Let's shift from aviation safety to the spirits industry, where Diageo is facing some headwinds.
Yeah, the company behind big names like Johnny Walker and Guinness had to cut its sales and profit forecast for the year.
What's driving the weakness?
It seems to be a global consumer pullback, especially hitting their higher-end products. They specifically cited softness in their two biggest markets, the U.S. and China.
So people are trading down, choosing less expensive options.
Looks like it. Particularly noted was weaker demand for high-end tequila in the U.S., which is a very competitive space now, and also slower sales of luxury Chinese spirits like Baijiu due to the economic slowdown there.
And this is happening while Diageo is also looking for a new permanent CEO?
Yes, adding to the uncertainty. Diebercreux left in July. Flat organic sales growth really underscores that even dominant luxury brands aren't immune when consumers feel financially squeezed and start cutting back on discretionary spending.
Okay, let's broaden our view again to some key global flashpoints and the economic pressures they're creating, starting with the war in Ukraine.
The situation there sounds increasingly grim, really settling into a brutal war of attrition. Russian forces are reportedly close to taking Pokrovsk in the southeast,
which would be their biggest gain in a long time.
In over 2 years, yes. but the sources emphasize it's coming at an insane cost in Russian lives. Moscow seems to be betting purely on its ability to outlast Ukraine through sheer mass, larger population, bigger industrial base.
While Ukrainian forces are stretched incredibly thin.
Severely understaffed. Some units are down to maybe 20% strength. They're facing constant drone threats that buzz of drones never stops, making movement and resupplying incredibly dangerous. It's a desperate fight for endurance and resources.
Shifting westward, we see the economic fallout from U.S. trade policy hitting Canada particularly hard.
Canada is uniquely exposed, isn't it? Sending about 75% of all its exports south to the U.S. President Trump's tariffs on autos, steel, aluminum are causing real pain, pushing the Canadian economy towards recession.
Unemployment rising, especially in manufacturing areas.
Yes. Ontario's unemployment rate, for example, is up significantly, and there are concrete examples of the damage.
Like the Stellantis plant in Brampton, Ontario.
That's a major one. Stellantis moved production of the Jeep Compass from Brampton to Illinois, specifically blaming the 25% U.S. tariff on Canadian-made vehicles.
How many jobs were lost there?
Around 3,000 workers, many already on layoff waiting for retooling, lost their jobs permanently. The ripple effect through the local economy and suppliers in Brampton is devastating, a direct hit from trade policy.
And looking across the Atlantic, tensions seem to be rising between the U.S. and Ireland.
Yes. Following the election of Catherine Connolly as president-elect in Ireland, she represents a far-left perspective and seems openly antagonistic towards U.S. interests.
Criticizing NATO, aligning more with China and Russia?
That's her rhetoric. She's expressed deep distrust of the U.S., and this is colliding with long-standing American frustration over Ireland's very low defense spending, just 0.2% of GDP.
What's the specific U.S. concern there? Security vulnerabilities?
Primarily. The worry is Ireland lacks the modern defense capabilities radar, cyber intelligence to protect itself, and by extension, the major American tech companies headquartered there, from espionage by rivals like Russia or China. These companies were attracted by low taxes. But now security is a concern.
So the U.S. view is basically that Ireland's had a free ride on security for too long.
That's the blunt assessment reported in the sources. The feeling is Ireland needs to contribute more to its own defense and align more clearly with Western interests, especially given its economic reliance on U.S. firms. Expect more friction there.
We also saw news indicating a strategic shift from Israel in its ongoing conflict.
Yes, they're starting a significant drawdown of reservists. Thousands are being sent home after 2 years of continuous mobilization.
Why now?
Two main reasons cited. Sheer troop exhaustion, reservists are worn out, their civilian lives and jobs are suffering, and the enormous, unsustainable economic burden of keeping such a large force activated for so long.
So the military is essentially making the decision based on practical necessity.
That's what one researcher suggested. The military isn't waiting for the political echelon because it has no choice. It signals a shift away from all-out war footing towards a more sustainable, lower-intensity conflict posture, even as fighting continues in places like Lebanon.
And finally, on the global stage, a rather embarrassing story out of Paris involving the Louvre Museum.
Embarrassing and alarming. Following that audacious theft of $102 million worth of crown jewels back in October, a state audit delivered a scathing verdict on the museum's management.
What was the main finding? Misplaced priorities?
Massively misplaced. The audit found that between 2018 and 2024, the Louvre spent $105 million on acquiring new art, but only $26.7 million, less than a quarter of that amount, on basic security and building maintenance.
They were buying art while neglecting security.
Essentially, yes. They bought over 2,700 new pieces, most of which weren't even put on display, while apparently ignoring warnings from a 2017 audit about significant security weaknesses. Weaknesses the thieves then exploited with relatively simple tools.
So the museum was warned, but focused on acquisitions instead of protection.
That's what the audit suggests. A failure of governance, prioritizing prestige over the fundamental duty to safeguard the priceless collection already in its care. The auditor called the theft a deafening alarm bell.
Okay, let's wrap up with a few more human-centric stories, some cultural footnotes showing competition and ingenuity in different arenas, starting on the horse racing track.
Yes, the Davis siblings. A really fascinating family rivalry playing out at the highest levels of New York horse racing. Dylan and Katie Davis.
Brother and sister, both top jockeys.
Exactly. Dylan, the younger brother, is already one of the best in the country. But Katie, his older sister, is rising fast and proving incredibly competitive. They race against each other constantly.
And their dad, also a famous jockey, acts as the referee.
Robbie Davis, Hall of Fame nominee himself, calls himself the family fireman because he has to cool things down in their text chain sometimes.
Katie took time off to have a baby, right? And came back even more competitive.
She did. She's quite petite, calls herself the Fat Davis, but came back saying she had something to prove.
And the rivalry is intense on the track.
Oh, yeah. Dylan says when they're in the starting gate, she's just competition he has to beat. And when Katie wins, especially against Dylan, apparently the family texts fly. She once posted a video of her beating him set to "Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better."
Leading to sibling intervention.
Their brother, Eddie, a trainer, apparently jumped in to defend Dylan. It sounds like high-stakes sport mixed with some pretty classic high-energy family dynamics.
From the track to the courtroom in D.C., the case of the flying Subway sandwich.
This one is truly bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Dunn, the guy who threw a foot-long sub at a federal agent during protests against the Trump administration, he was acquitted.
Acquitted of assault? How?
His lawyers successfully argued it was just a harmless gesture. They claimed the impact resulted in little more than, quote, mustard on the officer's uniform and onion hanging on his radio antenna.
Even though he threw it at an officer.
Yes. Prosecutors argued that political disagreement doesn't excuse throwing things at law enforcement. But the jury ultimately decided the sandwich didn't rise to the level of criminal assault. A strange legal footnote indeed. The power, or lack thereof, of lunch meat as a weapon.
And finally, let's end on a sporting note where a small rule change is having a huge impact. NFL kicking.
This is a great example of unintended consequences, or maybe intended ones. A seemingly minor off-season rule change is revolutionizing kicking.
What was the change?
Teams now get access to the official game balls, the K-balls used only for kicks before game day. 60 of them.
And that allows them to prepare them.
Exactly. They can legally manipulate them now. Before, the balls came straight from the factory, often rock hard. Now, teams can use techniques, wet towels, brushing the leather to soften them up before the game. It's legal preparation.
And the result is more long field goals.
Record-breaking numbers.
Yeah,
we're only partway through the season, and already there have been 7 field goals of 60 yards or more. That's already a single-season record.
Including that massive 68-yarder by Cam Little.
A new NFL record.
Yeah.
It's a completely different world from the old days when kickers resorted to secret dark arts, like microwaving balls to make them kickable. Legal ball preparation has made these monster kicks much more feasible.
So we've covered a huge amount of ground today, from Washington gridlock causing travel chaos and needing judges to order food stamp payments,
to corporate giants like Ford slamming the brakes on billion-dollar EV plans while Tesla bets a trillion on robots. It's just immense complexity everywhere.
And that thread of complexity, the sheer difficulty of navigating these systems, runs through everything, doesn't it? The Ukrainian soldier facing drone swarms, the Canadian worker hit by tariffs, the New Yorker wondering about new taxes under federal threats.
It really does. Which brings us back, maybe strangely, to that credit card story. The sheer effort needed for Eric May to track $2,600 in fees just to claw back maybe $3,500 in specific hard-to-use perks.
That difficulty, that friction, it's designed into the system, isn't it? Making it so complex that billions in value just get left on the table because it's too much hassle for most people.
Exactly. It benefits the issuer. Which makes you wonder, when you look at the political chaos in Washington, the shutdown, the tariff battles, the sheer unpredictability making planning almost impossible.
Is that complexity also, in a way, designed? Or at least does it function in a way that makes it incredibly difficult for the average citizen to even understand what's happening, let alone demand accountability?
If you need a spreadsheet and hours of work just to feel like you're breaking even on an $800 credit card, what does that say about the effort required to be an informed, engaged citizen in the face of government shutdowns and trillion-dollar corporate bets?
If navigating our consumer lives feels like a part-time job, does navigating our civic life now require the dedication of a full-time job? And if most of us can't or won't put in that time, who ultimately bears the cost of that complexity and our potential disengagement?
It's a challenging thought, connecting that everyday consumer friction to the massive institutional struggles we've discussed. Something to definitely chew on.
Indeed. We'll leave you with that thought. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
Until next time.